Thank you very much for coming out in such inclement weather for this Saturday evening rally of the Workers' Party of Britain. We have, many of us, been talking all day, which may be obvious from our hoarseness, but we're not done talking. And for those who have joined us for the evening, I hope very much you got some of the splendid food that was available, and there'll be food for thought from our speakers this evening. I'm just really opening the meeting now, and will conclude it with my own speech. But I'm joined by the three new deputy leaders of the Workers' Party. They all come from different backgrounds. His Excellency Peter Ford, former British ambassador from the Foreign Office, our man at the FCO, is no longer there, unfortunately, but he's able to bring that wealth of experience of international affairs, of diplomacy, and of, if you like, macro politics. He's the pioneer of our campaign for a referendum on net zero, which I've just described to journalists who interviewed me outside in the cold a minute or two ago. The freezing cold and the global warming world. It certainly ain't warming here, but has become, if you like, a fetish of the political class. And we've been led into one, down one avenue after another of impoverishment and cold, without ever having been consulted on whether we want to sacrifice our today and even our tomorrow for some theoretical purpose some decade or so from now. You might take one view on that, you might take another, but you'd have to agree that we've never actually been consulted. Nobody was ever asked to vote on whether or not we should all have to replace our boilers with heat pumps, whether or not we, having been encouraged, just happened to me actually, having been encouraged to buy a diesel car, are now told that diesel cars are entirely toxic, we have to get rid of them, whether to be told that we have to pay ULEZ charges in London and so on. So Honourable Peter Ford brings that to the leadership team. The incomparable Labour Member of Parliament, Chris Williamson, who was victimised in an early sign of what would happen to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party, is also now a new deputy leader of the Workers' Party. And I'm very proud of that, and proud of him, because he withstood, I said at the time, not everyone recognises the allusion, a long time ago, he's a modern Dreyfus. The Dreyfus affair in France, where a Jewish army officer was victimised by anti-Semitism, entirely unjustly, unfairly accused, convicted, punished. All of these things happened to Chris Williamson, when in fact, all he ever did was stand up for Jeremy Corbyn and Corbynism and some kind of idea of socialism within the Labour Party better than everyone else, better even than Jeremy Corbyn. And Chris Williamson conducted himself with grace and dignity and courage throughout that long period of victimization. And when he joined the Workers' Party, and now that he is deputy leader, I felt that this would strengthen us, but also strengthen him, because he's too talented a political figure to be out in the cold. He deserves to be in an organization living breathing political organisation that loves him and provide that warmth and support for him. Andy Hutt, who spoke several times during the day, as one of the leaders of one of the most important and most militant trade unions in the country, the ASLE&F, as I used to call them, ASLEF, as you will know them, is not just physically a tower of strength, not just morally a tower of strength, but, if you'll forgive the pun, is a bridge between us and what remains of the organised labour movement. I'm so old, I was a prominent labour movement activist when the unions had 12 million members. Now they have fewer than half of that. When the union leaders, Ray Buckton in the case of ASLEF, Jimmy Knapp and others in the case of the NUR, Jack Jones, the leader of my own union, Hugh Scanlon, the leader of the engineers, when these people were a power in the land and were better known than most cabinet ministers and who were in Downing Street as often as any cabinet leader, and is that bridge between us and that period, which was and must become again. Because the working class, if we can unite it, we had an amazing debate this afternoon, out of nothing, nowhere. We were filling time, waiting for the results of the elections. We talked about fan ownership of football clubs. We talked about the billionaires that buy and sell the football clubs nowadays. And one of our comrades, who knows little about football, raised the issue of the Super League. Why do I mention this? Because the Super League was a conspiracy, a plot hatched by the billionaire owners of the most elite clubs. And it was defeated. It was smashed by people's power. Suddenly, in an instant, millions of people, working class people, overwhelming, came together and stopped that Super League plan in its tracks. And that's the politics we believe in. We believe in popular power. We believe in people's power. And the mass of the people are workers. Some don't like to admit it. Somebody asked me yesterday, how do you define workers? I say, well, if you have nothing except your labor to sell, if you depend on wages or a salary to live, if you'll be in Queer Street if you lose 2 months' wages, for you have no savings, you have only your wages, your salary, you're working class. Whether you wear a white collar or a blue collar, whether you call yourself middle class or you don't, if you depend on renting out, selling your labour in any capacity, then you're working class. And such a class of such numbers deserves a party that speaks for them, that stands up for them, has no master except them. And the Workers' Party seeks to be that party. And every country needs one. Every country once had one. Britain had a Labour Party, but no longer has. No one can tell me that Sir Keir Starmer's outfit is a Labour Party. Whatever it is, whatever monstrosity it's become, it sure ain't Labour. It wouldn't even be able, with a straight face, to claim that it was any longer the party of the British working class. Even Keir Starmer would have difficulty making that case with a straight face. So it's our intention, if we can, and we'll fight until our last breaths, it's our intention to fill that void, fill that vacuum that now exists in British politics. Liberals have plenty to choose from. Tories have red and blue Tories to choose from. The workers at this moment have no alternative, and we aim to be that alternative. I'll speak more later about the immediate future, the elections that are coming up, and so on. But I want to introduce, as our first speaker of the evening, the Honourable Peter Ford, former British Ambassador.
Thank you very much, George, and thank you everyone for having me as one of the deputy leaders. I feel honoured, privileged, and pleased to be allowed to serve. Don't you hate it when people say they're glad to serve? Like almost every MP, when they get elected, they say, oh, I'm so glad to have this opportunity to serve the constituency. No, you're not. You're glad to have a career. So I'll tell the truth. I'm in it for the glamour and the money. No, that's a joke. Actually, they owe me money. But seriously, I'm glad to have a chance to make a contribution to a party I believe in. I'm a relatively recent recruit. I was already in NATO, and then I got groomed, I think that's the word, by Lauren and Paul, and we had a meal near my home, which I think will go down in history, probably like the Blair Brown meal. But we weren't plotting or a coup or anything. But they opened my eyes. For a long time, I've been one of the biggest admirers of our leader for decades. One of the happiest days of my life, in fact, was it 2005, George, your famous election victory? Yeah. That really more than made my day. It seemed justice was done, and a blow for truth and justice and peace was being struck. And I felt around the time of your campaign in Batley and Spen that really I ought to have been there canvassing for you. You still got a very creditable result there, but it did plant the seed of what's now happening today with my being inducted into the fraternity and being given this chance to serve. And what I hope I can serve you with is, as George mentioned, many years of practical experience inside Whitehall, inside the Foreign Office, inside our embassies abroad. So I've seen power from up close, the power of our own cabinet, and also power in the countries where I've served, like Syria and Bahrain, and I also served in America and in France. So I do have some experience of power, and I hope I can bring some of the lessons I've learned, practical lessons. What I hope I can contribute is not so much doctrine and ideology as practicalities of power, and try to keep us less of a debating society and more of a result-oriented party. Because I, like most of you, I think, are in it to win it. Not to win power, not yet anyway, but to get results, to make our presence felt in British politics, and I think we do that at an opportune moment. We're coming out of a period. I'm just reading a biography of Mussolini, how he emerged out of the First World War and was a leader of the veterans from that period. And maybe it's an exaggeration, but I have a feeling we're coming out of the COVID wars. 3 years, very difficult years, when the world was turned upside down. And then we emerged into a state of perma-crisis. After the COVID, the Ukraine war, the inflation war, now the Gaza war. So it's a time of political effervescence, but also opportunity. A good time, I think, to be a small but active and, I think, well-staffed party. So that's what I hope to contribute. Thank you very much.
I am humbled to be here, actually, and I'm surprised at the faith of some in this room have nominated me. I'm not sure I should thank them, but I appreciate their belief in me. But I suppose just kind of a little bit of background, because I feel like I've reached this point now, and I'm a part of the trade union, and I'm in the leadership team, but I kind of feel like I've failed. Because I think back to why I got into politics and why my beliefs shaped the way I was, and I was born in a council estate in Bristol, a single-parent family. My father was a single parent, and that was unusual in the 70s. But we were very poor. But then, when I looked down my street, everybody else was. I'd had my time in school when Maggie took the milk and all the rest of it. We had the free school meals, and we had vouchers for clothes to go to school in. But at the time, I left and joined the Navy. And I consider it now, that period as being an economic conscript. There was nowhere else to go unless you wanted to work in a factory. We'll work with the chemical works or the steel works or the docks. And I wanted to see the world. There was no way I was going to be able to afford that as a kid, so I'd done what most kids probably done. We wanted to travel the world, and I went and joined the Navy. And that shaped me in a particular way. You know, you're not a liberal when you're in the Navy. You are, you know, you're taught a certain politics to make what you're doing a bit more palatable. So I had an ideology then, and when I left the Navy, guess what? I was able to think for myself. And I saw that all the people that I've met during my time, I remembered all the people I grew up with, and realised that not much has changed, and actually it needs to change. We need to, you know, human beings, working people, what do they want? I mean, just the basics, a house, somewhere to live, to heat it, to be able to provide food on the table for your family and yourselves and clothes. You know, it's not a difficult scenario, but still now, 50 years later, and while I feel like I'm still, struggling to achieve what we got to achieve, is that that's still out there. In fact, it's probably worse. And as George mentioned, you know, the trade union powers and its might, you know, 12 million, 14 million is now down to under 6 million. And all the good things that have been done, and there have been some good things, have kind of been reversed, you know? And it's under different names. You know, I was told stories of the docks in Avonmouth where they used to chuck coins through the grill, and if you picked up a coin, that's your day's work. Well, what's the difference to that in zero-hours contracts? It's just called something else. So my point about all this is that we need change, and we need it rapidly. And one of the things that attracted me to this party, not only the policies that were set up, but of course a great leader is not afraid of anyone or anything on this earth, and you've got some kahunas, George, I must say. Not only that, but when I came to the first meeting of the Workers' Party, I met people like me. People who I recognised, people who I saw back on my street where I grew up. And they weren't, you know, they weren't lunatics. We had common sense ideas about providing common sense solutions to what is still a crushing problem. And today was a great example of our discussions And I love the way we decided our, you know, formulated our policy. We've ratified some of that today and probably some more tomorrow. What I get from that is an intelligent debate. It's you know, it's common sense. We've applied ourselves. We've applied our experiences to what we need to do. And we won't go down any cul-de-sacs of liberalism. Because, you know what? You know, when I speak to my neighbour across the fence, he's not particularly concerned about identity politics. In fact, he probably won't even know what it is. Actually, what he's on about is a pay rise. He's on about the community, about how it's gone downhill, you know, how it's so difficult to live, eat, and provide fuel to the car to get to work. These are the biggest concerns. And I think that was eloquently put today by a lot of the speakers. That is our focus. There will be things that we need to put a position on, and it's quite right we do that. But at the forefront is the workers, obviously, in this country. So I think with the leadership team, and again, I thank you, and I don't know why you've done that, you're all mad. We have a leadership team that's now, you know, diverse. We've got a membership that's diverse, every different background you can think of. And with the NMC and the new rules that we adopted today, I think we're going to have an agile decision-making process and an agile party to deliver the fight for the coming years. So I'm going to, being a trade unionist, I've kind of got that in my heart. And it breaks my heart that the trade union movement is not in the place it should be. You know, we should be, as trade unionists, based in the communities. You know, our heart and soul should be in the people that we're supposed to represent. But the membership's dwindling. Industry is leaving the country. We don't have industry anymore. We don't train our people up to be good workers and engineers. They're service jobs. We've got to recreate, rebuild industry. We've got to get back into the communities as trade unionists and connect with people and actually rebuild that. And the trade unions then have got to be reflective of the communities they're supposed to represent. We've got to recruit. We've got to make the trade unions bigger. And we've got to change the ways we make, you know, our position on the world. And that means, again, today, reflecting the decision today, which I was on the fence for a bit, but I think is what we need to do now for the future, is get the idea of workers' representations fully into these industries and businesses as a one step of a way of getting workers' representation there and actually doing the job what we were supposed to be doing. And of course, you know, that relationship with Labour, it's got to go. It's about time. In my short period, I say, I'm a sprightly 50-year-old, but I've seen the cycle already. You know, and I've been in and out of the Labour Party probably almost as quick as I joined it. But the disillusionment, the amount of people that they tagged along and brought along, hundreds of thousands of people in the Labour Party at one point, are behind an idea and an ideology that all of those things I mentioned about having a decent standard of living, getting a wage that feeds the house and not dependent on four or five wages in the house, four or five jobs, actually having the money to feed and clothe your families, those simple ideas. And hundreds of thousands of people rallied behind that. And then for what? It was sabotaged, betrayed. And that's what breaks my heart, because there are hundreds of thousands of people who really want change in this country. And I truly think if we carry on like we are, we've got the basis here, but if we carry on like we are with the authentic members that we've got and a dynamic leadership that makes decisions, I think we're going to be a force for nature in the coming years. But really? Thank you anyway.
The penultimate speaker, I gave a decent introduction to. But let me add this. Chris Williamson was one of the best members of Parliament. He was one of the best front bench spokespeople. He was one of Jeremy Corbyn's closest allies. And that's why he was rooted out, witch hunted out of Parliament. He's welcome here, though. Please welcome Chris Williamson.
It feels like coming home. I spent 44 years in the Labour Party, but it feels like coming home to be a member of the Workers' Party now, and we're very fortunate, others have already said this about George, but we're very fortunate to have a leader of the calibre of you, George. And I remember when I was suspended from the Labour Party, and this who I thought were my closest comrades in Parliament, in the socialist, so-called socialist campaign group, were running and diving for cover. And I spent 44 years as a member of the party, and I was very upset, very emotional, very, very hurt. Because it felt like I was being excommunicated from my family. This sort of Labour Party defined me. And George, who I didn't really know, I'd been on your show a couple of times, but what I would say about George is he's a personification of solidarity. And George used his considerable platforms to make the case about the injustice that I'd been subjected to and kept returning to it. He had a prominent show on Talk Radio, if you remember. Was it Talk Radio or Sport Radio? Talk Radio, yeah. With a big listenership, and it was very emotional, I've got to say, listening to George speaking. I mean, we're also fortunate because, in my opinion, George Galloway is the best orator in the world, actually. Everybody who saw him taking on those senators in the States is, you know, if ever you're feeling down, just Google that, and that'll lift you up again. It's absolutely brilliant. But, you know, George got people ringing in, and it was a very, really emotional. And that's the sort of solidarity that, you know, we should all aspire to, isn't it? Not be running for cover, not be ducking and diving and, oh, Chris, we're really sorry about what's happened to you, but you can't really come to the Socialist Campaign Group meeting tonight because it's the Socialist Campaign Group of Labour MPs. That was what the response that I got the day I was actually suspended. So it was, you know, that juxtaposition of the solidarity from George compared to the way in which the so-called Socialist Campaign Group of Labour MPs responded. I mean, couldn't have been more different. So it's wonderful to be part of a party, which I believe is indeed going places. And, you know, politics is broken, isn't it, in this country? That's the problem. All the political parties, all the mainstream political parties, really represent the same thing. They're all into neoliberalism. The kind of economic agenda is neoliberal. They're all enthralled to the military-industrial complex, to the war machine. And so there'll be real no difference, you know, if Labour gets in between Labour and the Tories, there'll just be some tinkering at the edges, so there'll be no real difference. And people are crying out for change. And there's no point looking to Labour MPs to try and deliver some of that change. I mean, and Peter, you know, made the point, they're all careerists. You're absolutely right, Peter, they are all careerists. And I was stunned, I was shocked, I couldn't believe it. I thought, I'm just a bricklayer from Derby. Why is it falling to me to be leading the charge on some of these really important issues? But I remember saying when we were trying to democratise the Labour Party that being a member of Parliament isn't a job and it ain't a career. And when you start to treat being a member of Parliament as a job or a career, you start to make decisions based on what's good for your job and what's good for your career. That's why none of the Socialist Campaign Group came to my support, or indeed anybody else's support for that matter. You know, people like Ken Livingstone, the man who in the autumn of his life was seen as a social pariah, is now suffering with Alzheimer's, and, you know, it's not in a good way. For somebody who probably did more in public office to advance the cause of anti-racism than anybody else, to be ostracised as some sort of bigot, as some sort of racist, is absolutely despicable. Absolutely despicable. When I defeated the Labour Party in the High Court after I was suspended for a second time and it was ruled unlawful, we used the cost that we won back from the Labour Party that we'd already raised to set up the Left Legal Fighting Fund. And we defended and supported Kent to try and get that appalling decision of the EHRC that was made against him, which was used against him and a woman called Pam Bromley to basically hang the label on Labour that it was kind of, you know, an institutionally anti-Semitic body. Complete nonsense, of course. Kent had nobody was coming to see him. No, none of the people that, you know, none of these prominent individuals that had really hung on Kent's coattails in the past were offering their support and solidarity. And he cut a very pathetic figure, an isolated man. And it really grieved me. You have to think, well, God almighty, you know, I'm the only person that's kind of, you know, showing this kind of level of solidarity to someone who is an icon, who's an elder statesman of the Labour movement. And, you know, for somebody who's done so much, given so much, to be, you know, isolated in that way in the latter years of his life, it was utterly shameful. And it says a lot, really, about the people in the Labour Party in particular who didn't actually give their support to Ken. And that's what's so different, I think, about the Workers' Party. And I believe that we do have a massive opportunity to fill a huge void in our politics in this country, because politics is absolutely broken, as I think I was saying. There is a massive need, and people recognise that none of the politicians really are actually speaking for them. And the biggest cohort in every election is always the non-voters anyway, and I think that's set to get even bigger. And I remember saying to Tom Harris, former New Labour, you probably know him, George, New Labour MP, lost his seat in Scotland in the big swing to the SNP. And he used to get on with a lot of these right-wingers, believe it or not, in the 2010 to 2015 the Parliament. And I was saying, look, what we need to be doing is giving people a reason to vote. You know, we need to be going after the non-voters, people who feel that the plague on both of your houses. And he says, no, 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 Chris, you don't understand. He metaphorically patted me on the head and said, the thing about non-voters is, Chris, they don't vote, so don't bother wasting your time on them. So that's the cynical attitude of people in the Labour Party. And they celebrate the fact that they don't really represent the working class anymore. I remember being at the Parliamentary Labour Party meeting after the 2014 local election results when Ed Miliband was still the leader. And we'd have quite a good result. But they were celebrating the fact that a lot of the support was coming from, they claimed, middle-class voters. And I remember Andy Slaughter, again, somebody you'll know, George, saying to me, have you still got many working-class voters in Derby North? And I said, well, I hope so. I think so. Oh, he said, and he kind of like poo-pooed the idea and was celebrating the fact, and was strutting around the meeting room that day about how it was the middle class that had enabled them to win Hammersmith and Fulham local authority. That's the sort of level that we're at. Either don't bother wasting your time on them, and just bother, you know, let's focus on the middle class. So, you know, we I think really can fill that void, and there is a huge need out there. And I was arguing that, you know, when I was in the Socialist Campaign Group, that we needed to be pushing the Labour Party to go considerably further than what Jeremy was doing. He was, for example, on the housing question, talking about you know, eradicating street homelessness, a laudable aim, but I would say we need to go considerably further than that. We were at that time, and now the sixth biggest, we were the fifth biggest economy in the world, but we're the sixth biggest economy in the world. I was saying, what we should be saying is that we will eradicate poverty in the lifetime of a parliament, never mind about eradicating street homelessness. That should be the aim that of course, it's not just pie in the sky. It's not just some sort of lefty kind of saying, some kind of, I'm a dreamer, of course, I'm a socialist, but it's doable. It's absolutely achievable, because we do have the resources at our disposal. It's just a lack of political will. And that's where I think we come in, because we can offer that alternative, and we can set out, demonstrate how we can actually deliver this change, address the housing crisis, eradicate the housing crisis, eradicate the poverty which blights so many lives in this country, deal with the fact now we're outside the European Union and not fettered by state aid rules. We can use the ability of the British government to ensure that we support British industry. Because, look, when I left school in Derby, there was 120,000 people working in manufacturing, around 20,000 people working in the railway, 20,000 working at British LNEs, which had been razed to the ground there. Nobody works there at all anymore. 35,000 people working at Rolls-Royce alone. Most of those jobs have gone. I mean, Rolls-Royce is still the biggest employer in Derby, one of about 11,000 people. But 20,000 have disappeared. Where have they gone? Well, back in the day, John Maynard Keynes made a speech in 1930 saying that my grandchildren, i.e. George's and my and Peter's generation, will only be working, his grandchildren's generation, will only be working 15 hours a week because of the march of new technology. Well, new technology's come, but it hasn't delivered as a 15-hour working week, has it? I mean, people are working longer than they've ever done now. Working two, like in the United States of America, people, working class people, often they're having to work two or three jobs just to try and make ends meet. Well, we could change that, couldn't we? We could say, we are going to make technology be our servant, not our master. And, I mean, one of the things I used to argue and still argue today is that we should become 21st century Luddites. Because all the Luddites were saying is they weren't against new technology. They were saying we should use technology to our benefit. It should be our servant, not our master. So that's what I think we should be arguing for. We'll have a proper industrial strategy, the way we will support British jobs here and making sure that there are opportunities and that we stop companies offshoring jobs to low-wage economies and they keep the manufacturing jobs, for example, here in this country. We can actually address the crisis in our public services as well. They're in meltdown, aren't they? There's a massive social care crisis in the country. We need to deal with that. The National Health Service, I think Bob Gill's here. If people haven't seen his film, Dr. Bob Gill, The Great NHS Heist, talks about how... well worth watching if you haven't seen it. And spread it around. Because they're totally destroying our National Health Service. They're privatising a vast bulk of it. And, you know, Bob will give you a chapter and verse on what they've done. We need to be reversing all that. Who's offering that? Nobody is offering that in the mainstream. The Labour Party's ruled out any renationalisation if it's somehow, you know, it's unaffordable. What a load of nonsense. Unaffordable? It's easily affordable, apart from the fact that, you know, we're having a debate about modern monetary theory at some point, but, you know, we are a currency-issuing government, so we can never run out of money, but that's an issue that we'll return to. But just look at it. I mean, the water industry, for example, I got the House of Commons Library to do some research for me, and this was in about 2018, I think it was. And it showed, I can't remember what the figures were now off the top of my head, but it's something like they'd made about £24 billion in profits since privatisation. They'd paid about a few hundred million only in corporation tax, but paid out something like about £22 billion in dividends shareholder dividends. Well, if we didn't have shareholders, we could use that money, couldn't we, to invest in the water infrastructure and to reduce people's water bills. And the same is true for all the utilities, but then none of that is on offer from either the Labour Party or the Tory Party, and I think people are crying out for that response. When Giles Brandreth went round Guildford looking for secret socialists, if people saw that on the Daily Politics, and he was asking people, do you think that we should scrap tuition fees, for example, and they were saying, well, yes, that's a good idea, do you think we should make the National Health Service properly run for the public by the public sector and throw out the privateers? Oh yes, that's a good idea. You know, bring the railways back into public ownership, regulate the private rented housing market. Everybody was in agreement with it. And then he said, "Well, you're a secret socialist, then, sir or madam." And then he turned his clipboard round. There's a big picture of Jeremy Corbyn, and they sort of recoiled at that point because obviously they'd done a number on him in terms of the propaganda against it. But what that revealed was that the policies are popular. Socialism is popular. Common sense socialism is what most people actually want, even though they might not realise it. When you actually break it down, about bringing the utilities into public ownership, kicking the privateers out, getting rid of the privateers in the rented market, and so on and so forth, people instinctively see that is the right way to go. Nobody else is offering that now. So it does give us a huge opportunity to fill that void that is there. It's a glaring void. And I'm hopeful and confident, actually, that you know, this is the beginning of a really exciting journey. And I look forward to the day when we're carrying George over the threshold of whether it be the mayoralty in London or the threshold of the House of Commons, maybe the threshold of 10 Downing Street. Wouldn't that be wonderful, eh? George Galloway, eh? As Prime Minister. Imagine if George Galloway had been the leader of the Labour Party and not Jeremy Corbyn. He wouldn't have put up with those Zionists lying about anti-Semitism, weaponising anti-Semitism. He wouldn't have tolerated those right-wing arseholes, excuse my French, in the parliamentary Labour Party. He would have actually stood up to them and actually plotted a proper course for the party, for the country, and I think we would have had a far better chance of actually winning through had that been a possibility. I mean, one of the things, many mistakes Jeremy made was not bringing George back into the Labour Party, which George would have been willing to come back into the party again at that time. Well, that's gone, that's history now. Our duty now is to destroy the Labour Party, because the Labour Party is a bigger barrier to socialism than at the circuit club. I just say, a lot of people are really fed up with politics. I mean, we talked about some of the stuff today, the football supporters and so on. So there are so many opportunities for us. We've got a really exciting agenda, I think, going forward. And as we lay out our programme going forward, I'm hopeful and confident that we will see more and more people rallying to the Workers' Party cause. And I do think we will make some electoral breakthroughs when at the general election, whenever it comes. But thanks for your support. Wow. And let's talk to you.
Well, there you see the breadth of our new leadership, the international and diplomatic front, the wages front, the parliamentary front, and picking up on some of the themes that have been developed in these earlier speeches. I was reminded of something I said to Jeremy Corbyn. I don't normally divulge private conversations, but I drew on my own experience from the mean streets from whence I come. If you don't run, they can't chase you. But if you run, they will chase you until they can overwhelm you and destroy you. And that is exactly what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. He should have, from the first day, made clear that he completely rejected the premise that opposition to Israel, opposition to Netanyahu and his gang, had anything to do with Jews, still less with hating Jews. No one credibly could have established that Jeremy Corbyn, who made race, like Ken Livingstone, made race and anti-racism something of a fetish, actually. You could not get more anti-racist than Jeremy Corbyn. And yet now he stands believed by tens of millions of people in this country as an anti-Semite. If that line had been defended properly, if that allegation had been fought resolutely, both he and we would have been in a far better position than we are today. Jeremy Corbyn came within less than 4,000 votes distributed across the marginal constituencies of being the Prime Minister of Britain. That's how close it was. That's how big the surge was, as Andy was talking about. He got that close. And now he's essentially an isolated man with no party around him, alone in the House of Commons and oftentimes not even finding the right note, I'm sorry to say. We are, of course, ready to work with Corbyn and with any other individuals or forces for good. Our motto is Smethwick's not far away. Malcolm X walked the streets of Smethwick. He put it this way: we will ally with anyone for good and with no one for ill. That's our approach. So we are open to collaboration, cooperation, alliance with other forces, sometimes only on one issue, or two or three issues. Rarely, unlikely, on all issues. We're ready for that. We're not sectarian. We showed in the organization we founded, No to NATO, No to War, that you don't need to pass any kind of political blood test to work with us. If you accept that war and NATO are two sides of the same coin, then whatever else you believe in, whatever other politics you hold, we will work with you and cooperate with you. And that No to NATO, No to War, in just a year has become a mass presence online, but also on the streets. We have won the argument amongst millions of people that NATO and the imperial war machine ineluctably leads to one bloody war after another. We've won that argument. No one could credibly dispute it. What we said about Ukraine is turning out daily to be true. What they, our enemies, said about Ukraine is daily demonstrated to have been a lie. What we said about the nature of the political nationalist ideology of Zionism is being demonstrated in technicolor, blood spattered technicolor on everyone's screen, not their television screen, because that continues to be a daily lie. But fewer and fewer people are relying on their television screen to tell them what's actually happening. I became involved in the Palestinian cause in 1975. So, a very long time ago indeed. And no one, I think I can say, no one in this country has been involved for longer or more prominently than me. I was talking with Peter from Edinburgh, Peter Gregson from Edinburgh, just a few moments ago. I twinned my city of Dundee with the Palestinian city of Nablus in 1980, 43 years ago. The mayor of Nablus, whose legs had been blown off in a Zionist terror bombing, came on his tin legs from Palestine to Dundee and gave us a Palestinian flag, which was promptly flown on the town hall and which still flies on the town hall 43 years later. No one has been involved in that issue longer or more prominently than me. And I have seen a lot of suffering, a lot of disaster visited upon the Palestinian people. But Chris was kind. I said to Chris, I will never leave you alone. And I never have left him alone, long before he joined the Workers' Party. But I said the same to Yasser Arafat in Beirut in 1977. I was hanging around in Beirut after the others had left. I was regularly meeting and eating with him, but finally he said to me, you have to go home. I have enough fighters here. You can do much more for our cause by returning, as it happened, to Scotland and becoming a Labour Party official, secretary, organiser of the Dundee Labour Party. And I said to him exactly the same words. I said, I promise you I will never leave the Palestinian cause alone. And I never did. And I have been faithful to that promise ever since. But I have never seen the kind of evil that we are all watching now on our screens. As a father of six children and with five grandchildren, I can't look at them without seeing these images that we are watching on our phones and on our computer screens. I cannot think of my own children without imagining the depravity of decapitating, blowing the limbs off, murdering small children, and expecting the world to support it. That level of evil is difficult to comprehend, but
But I'll tell you something even more difficult. It's even more difficult to comprehend that our leaders in Western countries are still supporting a genocide that's happening in front of our eyes, even though they know that the vast majority of the public wants it to stop. That's even more difficult to comprehend and has only one possible explanation. Well, two, actually. One of them doesn't bear thinking about. Either that they have been suborned and or blackmailed into doing so. Perhaps that's what Jeffrey Epstein's house was about, his island was about in some cases. And the only other alternative is that they don't care what we think about it. That they are ready to support it, whether we like it or not. And that then opens a big question for us. And that question is this. Are we going to allow politicians who have supported this slaughter, paid for this slaughter, armed this slaughter, propagandized for this slaughter, are we going to allow them to continue to sit in their careers, their jobs, their offices, their big salaries? Are we going to be taken for granted or not?
No.
And I have a very strong feeling. I can speak only for Britain, but I think it applies elsewhere. That now has come the time where millions of people want to punish the politicians responsible for all this. It might not last forever. They might recover. But this year, coming 2024, by the grace of God, is election year. It's election year locally and nationally. And thus we have the godsend. You know, Dr. Johnson said that the knowledge that one is to be hanged in the morning concentrates the mind wonderfully. All these politicians, metaphorically, are facing being hanged next year. And it's up to us to hang those who will not move and who will not accept the people's demands for an end to this great crime, to this great injustice. I've been doing some crunching of numbers. There's at least 50 constituencies in Britain where the majority enjoyed by the sitting member of Parliament is less, in many cases, vastly less than the number of people in those constituencies for whom this slaughter in Gaza is a step too far that they will not support. That means if we can rally those thousands in those, let's call it 50 constituencies, to support us or support candidates like us, we can knock out every single one of those members of Parliament. And you know, if the performance of Sunak and Cleverly and the Conservative cabinet is disgusting, surely the performance of the so-called Labour opposition is much, much worse, because they overwhelmingly are the members of Parliament that depend on us, that depend on the votes of people for whom Gaza is important, even sacred. Sacred. It's not a small word. Sacred. It's as profound a word as it's possible to imagine. Within walking distance of this hall, there are Labour MPs supporting this slaughter who have thousands of constituents who can't bear any longer to see these pictures and witness this catastrophe that is happening. If we can rally those constituents, we can vote these people out. And we're determined to try and do so. Therefore, in the general election that's coming up, it might be in January, it might be in May, it might be next December, but it can't be any later than that. The Workers' Party will field up to 50 parliamentary candidates in the general election of 2024. As I say, we're ready to discuss with others. If they have a better chance than us, okay. But in up to 50 constituencies, we can make the difference. Now, victory can be defined many ways. Maybe we will win those constituencies. That would be the best victory of all. But it's equally a victory if we punish the criminals that made this slaughter possible by making them lose is a victory for us and for the people suffering in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, in Syria today. And so we're going to try and do it. And I'll tell you this, they're extremely worried about the impact we can make. There are constituencies in Britain represented by supporters of Keir Starmer's line, which I remind you, he very helpfully put it in words in writing himself. I support Zionism unequivocally. He said, I unequivocally support Israel. Our answer is, okay, we'll make sure that those who disagree with you have an opportunity to vote for an alternative. And that alternative is us, the Workers' Party of Britain. You all know the constituencies I'm talking about. Now, we don't have ready-made candidates for all of these constituencies. And so I say this now. If you're watching this and you want to stand for Parliament as one of our candidates, come forward now. Come forward. We'll interview you. We'll vet you. And if you're the best man or woman for the job, we'll support you with everything that we can do. Come forward. Step up. Step up to the mark. And let's have justice for the Palestinian people. And there are many, many, many people in the country who are ready to respond to such an approach. In London, do you know how many people there are in London who care about Gaza? Muslim people? Afro-Caribbean people, Generation Z people, student people, working class people of all kinds and races who care about Gaza. It's millions. There's a million Muslims alone in London. It's millions. If we could get a fraction of those millions to support me for mayor of London, Sadiq Khan is out. Out. With a capital letter. Out. And we're going to offer that alternative. I told the Congress earlier, it's quite onerous, you know, standing for mayor of London. Apart from anything else, you've got to get 10 signatures in 33 London boroughs, including the city of London, where my supporters are a little bit thin on the ground, in the square mile. I'm telling Sadiq Khan right now, I already have those 330 signatures on paper ready to stand against you. As a matter of fact, given the history of dirty tricks I've actually got 660. I've done it double, duplicate, just in case there's any slip up. So one way or another, in 2024, this is going to be a big year for us. And I believe that we will make significant progress. And my goodness, we need it. Not just for these international reasons, not at all. As a matter of fact, we wish that things were different and that we could concentrate on the big crisis in which our people are now sunk. This is the worst state that we've been in since 1940 and 41. Now, there's no Churchill, there's no Bevin to step forward and Attlee, others. There's no one who can step forward and rescue our country, which is tossing like a cork on the ocean waves, leaderless, rudderless, sinking. That's the country we now live in. I was listening very closely to what both Andy and Chris said, and remembering about the person who asked me yesterday to define working class. It was clear from the nature of the tone of the question that this person believed there was no such thing anymore. But let me invite you to look around you. Everything you see in this room and everything you see outside and everything you have and use when you go back home was made by a worker. None of it came like a puff of magical smoke. Someone made it. Someone mined it. Someone extracted it. Someone manufactured it. Someone packaged it. Someone transported it. Someone sold it. All of these tasks were carried out by workers. Our problem is, most of them were carried out by workers who worked for less in other countries because our capitalists exported our jobs that we had done, that our fathers and mothers had done, exported them. I once had a debate against one of Trump's men, Bannon, Steve Bannon. He said, the Chinese have stolen our lunch. I said, it was the American capitalists that stole your lunch. It was them that relocated their factories in China, where the workers worked for less than the American workers worked. Why blame the Chinese? Blame your own ruling class and demand that American jobs are brought back to America to be done by Americans. And that's what we need to, that's the spirit that we need to reconnect with. Almost all of us have got cars. Why aren't we building our own cars, our own buses, our own trucks, our own motorbikes, our own railway carriages, rolling stock? Now that we're out of the European Union, we are entirely free to invest in our own industries, to procure only from our own industries. We can tell the ambulance service, you're only going to buy British ambulances. We can tell the railway companies, you're only going to buy British rolling stock. But that requires us to have the manufacturing capacity to make these things. And we must rediscover that. Because there's no future for us as a service economy. You've seen the weather outside. How many tourists do you think we can attract? How many of us can make a living serving ice cream to foreign visitors? Our only basis of national salvation is to rediscover our industrial past. We discover our industrial greatness. And it's not that we can't do it. How can it be that we can't do it? Who made Rolls-Royce? Who developed these engines that became famous throughout the world? Who we were building ships of steel in Britain when the Americans were still cowboys, slaughtering the Red Indians in the Wild West. We were building great ships of steel. Sparks flew everywhere here in the West Midlands. The Black Country. Why was it called black? Because of the smoke of manufacturers. We made everything here. As a matter of fact, we invented a lot of the things that now exist, especially in Scotland, where we invented most of them. We're not some country or nation of inadequates. We're a highly educated population with a great reserve of skill and industry, but we have to rediscover it. And we have to rally it and mobilize it and organize it. And that requires political change, because be sure, our ruling elite are quite happy with this, for them, comfortable decline. They've got their foreign homes. They don't spend much time worrying about whether the people here in Birmingham in this bitterly cold night can afford to heat their houses or not, have to choose between eating and heating or not. They don't really care that your old mother is sitting with two cardigans and a coat on because she can't heat her house, given that the electricity and gas bills have doubled and trebled and quadrupled, largely as a result of deliberate policy decisions made by our own government. They are sitting pretty. The politicians, Chris will tell you, it's a great life, if you like that sort of thing. No heavy lifting. Your shirt's still white when you get home. £85,000 a year wages, with another £85,000 in expenses. Two houses. Get treated with respect, even veneration, in the places you choose to go. It's a great life. They don't feel it, you see. They don't feel the pain of the working class in this country. Never mind the unemployed, the underemployed, even the pain of the workers that once upon a time the Labour Party was created to serve. Common sense socialism is what we stand for. And the common sense is just as important as the socialism. We're not dreamers. Well, Chris said he is. I've grown out of dreaming myself. We do have ideals and we do have wishes, but I'm a practical person. I think I know what's needed. I think I know what can be achieved. And our socialism goes with the grain of the British public. See, when I see, as I saw in, where was it, Gayatri, in Hammersmith, I think. It might have been just over the border. When I saw a rainbow zebra crossing, and especially when I learned that that zebra crossing cost £40,000, when there was a perfectly adequate black and white zebra crossing there before, and then I realized that the council that did this called itself Labour, I realized these people have lost all connection to common sense. Only an idiot does that. Even the police horses won't cross it. The police horses draw up, shocked at it. When I watch this apparently endless obsession with people's sexuality, with people's gender, we've got a class of politicians who can't even define what a woman is, refuse to define what a woman is. We've got a health service, Dr. Bob, where the word woman is disappearing from the signage, where it's no longer breastfeeding, it's chest feeding, where it's no longer mothers, it's people who give birth. And all of that identity politics madness, which people think has something to do with being left-wing. I realize why being left-wing is increasingly unpopular amongst people with common sense. We have to redefine that. We're not going to paint your zebra crossing in rainbow colors. We honor women, cherish women, and their sacred role in our society, without whom none of us would exist. We stand up for women's rights. We defend children. We will not have, and I have five young children. I refuse to have sexuality thrust at my small children in school. I refuse it. I'd rather take them out of school and educate them myself if I have to. I will not have people telling 7, 8, 9-year-olds about matters that await them many years later. As Lady Astor said, do what you like, but don't frighten the horses. I say, do what you like. I don't care what you do, but not in front of my children. And you're not going to teach my children that your particular peculiarity, and we all have them, your particular peculiarity is something that my children need to know about. This kind of madness has nothing to do with common sense socialism. I was once very privileged indeed to be a part of a conversation involving Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. How about that? I was in the room with Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. And we'd just been at a parade where the soldiers, when they drew up, chanted socialismo o muerte, socialism or death. Fidel didn't like it. And he said to Chavez, in my presence, stop talking about socialism. Just concentrate on doing socialist things. Do socialist things. And when the people like them, then you tell them, yeah, that's socialism, you know. Do socialist things. Make people's lives better. Make them happier, more secure, more safe. And then tell them, you know, we did these things because we believe in common sense socialism. That's the Workers' Party of Britain. I hope everyone joins it. Thank you very much.